and welcome to Future Library. Today, my guest is—he's been involved in practically every band ever, if you are to believe the Wikipedia page. Well, I should say every band ever in the kind of good underground stuff in the UK. He's been involved with Movietone, Flying Saucer Attack. He's done work with Hood, Mogwai. He's played with Jan Tiersen of Amelie fame. He's recorded as Third Eye Foundation. And if you've read the title of the podcast, which you probably have because you've downloaded it, you'll know that I'm speaking to Matt Elliott. How are you doing, Matt?
Quite fine, thank you very much.
Excellent news. Now, I'm going to indulge in a little bit of Jules Holland-esque subterfuge here. We're going to pretend that it's March when the show is actually going to be released, whilst it's actually deep, dark January. But I like the listeners to think that maybe... In fact, let's pretend the show's going out live, listeners. What you're listening to right now is live, exactly like Jules Holland's Hootenanny. And if the show ever becomes well-known, then I'm sure the Daily Mail will have a big complaint about that. Matt, I know a lot about you from various things, that having kind of followed your work for a while. There's going to be some people listening who don't. Do you want to give us a quick overview of what you've been doing?
Well, I started off in the mid to late 90s, basically doing sort of weird dark electronica, and then from around 2000 onwards started doing kind of darkish folk. And I was born in Bristol and grew up in Bristol and now live in France.
And whereabouts in France do you live? I mean, obviously not the address, but...
North East France, near Luxembourg.
And how do you find living in France?
Well, I've been here for 13 years or so, so I start to understand a bit how it works. I mean, it's the same as any other country in that it's got good things and bad things.
You see, one of the things that really kind of that always sticks very much in my mind is the song you released on, I think originally via MySpace, on the, was it the day after Sarkozy got re-elected?
Yeah.
That time. Yeah. It's one of those that really kind of has stuck, and it's one of the your songs that I kind of find myself humming in kind of idle moments. It seems that there's, listening to your work, would I be right in thinking there's a kind of... left-leaning in your politics?
Well, I'm an anarchist, probably. This is the closest way to explain my political philosophy. So, I mean, if we're going to live if we're going to have to live in a system with a government, of course I'll probably go more socialist. So in that respect, yeah, you could call me left-leaning, yeah.
Yeah, that was the thing. I didn't want to kind of say socialist because I didn't want to kind of label you before you then, you know, said it yourself. But yeah, that is the vibe I've had. It's very much a kind of a socialist left-leaning...
An actual socialist, not what socialism is.
Oh, no.
In Europe, yeah. Now, you know, I mean, what socialism, the principles of socialism as they were when they were first... first described or discovered or whatever.
It's kind of proper socialism where it's all about, I'm trying to think of how to describe it, the proper use of the society is as everybody being equal and working towards the good of the society, and the good of the society being the good of the individual, and vice versa.
We've never really seen government of the true socialist government ever, so we'll never really know whether that's it will work or fail. But I mean, if we get onto politics, I think that all of those systems are so kind of outdated, and most of them were kind of come up with before even planes existed, so it's not really relevant to now, the world we live in, with the internet, for example, which is a massive thing, and as we've seen in the last couple of years, it's thrown up all kinds of new kind of moral problems for us to deal with, which actually I don't think we're dealing with very well at all. But that's often the case with humanity, that we end up dealing with stuff after it's already happened, and it's already a bit too late in a way.
Yeah, I think there's certainly, I think the internet certainly has been something that's it's really kind of unprecedented, and it's almost like we don't know how to deal with it as a species. That this thing has popped up that is very... when it's got proper net neutrality and openness, it can be a very kind of socialist kind of... almost sort of separate world where everybody can be equal and is all on the same footing. I think there's a certain movement by governments and corporations to try and pull it away from that, which I think it'll be... I think it'd be very sad if, you know, we're looking back in 20, 30 years' time and telling kind of children and grandchildren that the net used to be this kind of open world where people could do and say what they wanted, and is now kind of locked down by governments. I think that'd be a real pity. But I think without wanting to kind of harp on about the socialism thing, I mean, I found that as I've got older, I've become more and more that way myself. And I have joked to my wife that by the time I'm 50, I'll probably be a full-on Marxist or something like that. I like the idea of everybody having the same as everybody else and everybody being treated properly equally. But, like you say, it would be extremely difficult to probably implement.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that with all of these systems, it's human corruption is basically the source of all of humans' problems. And every reason why every single system has failed is because of the classic corruption. But I think that you're right that the internet basically took everyone by surprise, but it actually gave us sort of citizen normal folk, as it were, a bit of a heads up, because we started to understand the power of it and the implications of it before the government did. Now government and corporations and all the rest, the people that really pull the strings, are exactly as you say, trying to basically launch an assault on the internet. And I think, tragically, what you described is going to be very close to the truth. Is that we will, if we're still allowed to even talk to our kids about such a subject, that we will say, yes, in those days, they were the glory days. It was freedom. We could do everything we wanted to. We could express ourselves with no legal recourse. And now you're finding kids, 16-year-old kids, being extradited and threatened prison for years for doing crimes that aren't really that dangerous. I mean, certainly less dangerous than some of the sort of corporate failings, basically, that have happened, that have landed us in this massive economic shitstorm. Those people managed to walk away without any kind of recourse, but these young lads, most of them who have sort of mental problems and issues, are facing huge criminal trials, not even in their home country, not even in the country where they committed the crime. Anyway, I mean, that's another thing.
No, I absolutely agree with that. I mean, I think the thing that's I'm finding kind of alarming at the moment is the way that, on the one hand, I think people should expect to be held to account if they say something that's, you know, really kind of wrong on the internet. If they say something that's, you know, like there's the example of the little boy that was found dead in Scotland recently, and somebody's been arrested for posting something that I think was some racist hate speech. And on the one hand, I think that, I don't know, it's a difficult one, because I kind of want people to have the freedom of speech to say what they want, but at the same time, some things should be unsaid. But I don't know, I find it such kind of, I find myself torn over it.
I know what you mean, but I think the thing is basically that kind of thing where people just try to say the most offensive thing, or worse, if they actually do genuinely believe it, which might be the terrible, tragic case. But it's because generally I think people need to be educated a bit more, you know, for freedom to really truly exist. People need to be aware of at least the bare minimum of what's acceptable and what isn't acceptable. And although, I mean, the reason I'm an anarchist is my mother explained to me when I was quite a young child, actually. She said that being an anarchist isn't about being like a punk and spitting and doing whatever the hell you want. it's actually the opposite of that. It's taking responsibility for your actions and realizing that, your actions have consequences and this, that, and the other, and to basically be aware of those things that are going on around you, and not, it's almost the inverse of doing what you want. You have to be aware and take responsibility for your actions yourself, instead of letting someone say, don't do this, don't do that. And I had the argument with my father about, he's the kind of person that thinks that if the police were to suddenly disappear tomorrow, that everyone would immediately start raping and killing each other, which isn't the case. That I don't kill or rape or steal because I'm afraid of prison. I don't do those things. I don't want to do those things. I don't need someone to tell me not to do those things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it comes down to kind of empathy, doesn't it, with other people? If we know, I mean, when it comes down to it, we share, well, genetically, we're almost identical with every other human on the planet. So if something feels a certain way to us, we can be fairly confident that it's going to feel that way to most of the people we encounter. And, you know, I don't want to be murdered, so I don't want to murder somebody.
Yeah, exactly. You
know, I don't want to be raped, so I don't want to rape somebody. The empathy side of it is we have the ability to imagine how it would feel to be the person at the receiving end of something like that, and we can kind of almost simulate ourselves into their position and understand it from the point of view of somebody, you know, who's being attacked, and know that we wouldn't want to put that on somebody else. And I think most people are generally good, and this is something that I may have this kind of naive, kind of optimistic feeling about people. I think that when pushed to it, most people will be generally good people. It's like you see in disasters or whatever, when there's, like, say, a huge earthquake and a place is completely destroyed, people don't go on rampages. They don't start looting what they can and destroying what they can. They tend to actually chip in and help each other. So, yeah, I don't think society would collapse. I think there'd be certain elements that would take advantage if the police disappeared overnight, but...
Yeah, of course, and that you have to ask yourself, how did those people get to that state as well? But then I don't want to be all of those, you know, like, to always blame society or whatever, but, I mean, I think in a lot of cases society is to blame. But it's true that I think I agree with you that most humans do good. Otherwise, we simply wouldn't have got as far as we've got now, because we would have already wiped ourselves out. So I think, I mean, it's the same with all of these security things. Exactly. When there's a system of control, they always say, for your security. Now, whenever I see that, for your security, you have to do this. For your security, you have to take your shoes off when you go to the airport. For your security, you have to do it. I know that it's bullshit, because they've got no other reason to say it. For your security, we're reading and storing your phone calls and emails. For your security, it's massive bullshit. So they convince us that we do need to have all of these systems of control in place. And in a way, they deliberately let society get fucked up, because then people will provide them with the things that they so desperately need, which is extremists and people that are so messed up that they do end up either taking pleasure in just insulting people, like on the internet, exactly as you were saying earlier, or doing something which obviously is much more personal and horrible and serious.
I mean, one of the things that has been mentioned on the podcast before, I'm kind of a big fan of the late sci-fi author Ian Banks, and he very much was, he had this kind of attitude that socialism and anarchy would be the way forward. I mean, I don't know if you've ever read any of his sci-fi novels, but the world that he creates in that is there's a society called the Culture, and they're basically an anarchist, post-scarcity anarchist society, and the decision making is made by benevolent artificial intelligences, and there's no law at all. It's just reputation it's based on. It's like, if you do something bad, people are going to then look at you and go, "No, you're not a very good person," and will shun you. So everybody kind of, you know, acts nicely to each other. And I kind of wonder if we reached a point of not having to fight over resources, would we get there in the end?
Well, I think that there is an argument for that. I mean, sure, in the Zeitgeist trilogy films, I don't know whether you've seen those or not, but that pretty much suggests that, and I'm in agreement with that, because that's almost sort of ultra socialism. It's basically taking stock of all of the resources that we've got now, trying not to waste the remaining ones now, but to use them to our best advantage, and to try and the ironic thing is now that we've actually got the technology to live in quite a good, I mean, I don't expect everyone to be reduced down to poverty. I don't think that that's even necessary. I think that we could all live quite a nice life with pretty much most of the things we certainly most of the things we need, and perhaps some of the extra things that we want as well, but everyone could have that. And me personally, I'd live a lot happier knowing that everyone else has got a much, pretty much the same. You know, they've got exactly what they need, plus a few extra luxuries. If you like to go skiing, you can go skiing. I mean, we can all live in quite a reasonable life and have them for more than a bare minimum. It's just a question of efficiency. And capitalism is a very inefficient system, because we just end up throwing most of the stuff away in a way to sort of generate false income. So it's completely... And it's so that the extremes are so far that it's not actually sustainable. And in fact, any situation where there's been a revolution is when the richest have, when it's so massively disproportionate that something happens and everyone just goes, okay, enough. And that's the same when they measure society's happiness or a country or a culture's happiness. That is also the same. That's also based on how close the richest and the poorest are. And the closer they are together, the general happiness goes up.
Absolutely. And I think you're right about capitalism, that it seems to be designed to chuck all the money up the way to the few people at the top who control everything, who ironically are the people who usually do the least in the companies they are running, and keep it, you know, pulling it away from the people who actually do all the work, whilst making the people at the bottom want to buy the things that they're maybe involved in making in the first place, for more money than they're maybe making to make those things, if that makes sense. And it's not good.
And of course, adding built-in obsolescence, so that we're constantly needing a source of these things, of these goods. You know, I mean, you can't buy anything that's built to last certainly more than 10 years now. I mean, if you look at cars, for example, you'll see some very old classic cars that manage somehow to survive through just because someone's looked after them. But then you won't see many cars older than 10 years old. And if you do, they are shagged.
Yeah.
Everything is deliberately replaceable. And more so. I mean, it's really... So that's a massive waste of resources as well. Nothing's made to kind of upgrade. I mean, I'm the computer I'm doing this on is 8 years old, which I sort of... I'm doing now. I'm saying, wow, it's 8 years old and it still works. I'm still amazed that it does. That's how ingrained in that I've become, even aware.
Oh, that's it. I mean, you find yourself, if you get past 5 years with something, you so go, 5 years old, still going strong.
Yeah, that's what a bargain that was. I paid, you know, like half of my mum's earnings on that thing. You know, I mean, it's quite amazing. It's also quite tragic, you know.
I think the only things I can think of that have been built to last that I've ever bought, apart from things like books, which if obviously, again, if you look after them, they're okay. But things like guitars and amplifiers, those seem to be fairly rugged.
Well, I mean, not if you bought anything new in the last 20 years. I mean, I made the mistake of buying the last electric that I bought new, because I thought, well, that way I can guarantee that the neck's not warped and all that. But it's been terribly made. The neck warped almost instantly. And actually, I tried two of the same model, same color, and they sounded completely different. And it's just bad quality. If you buy, I mean, I have a hand-built Spanish guitar, which was built to last and is a great thing and will hopefully last all of my life. Some bicycles are meant to last perhaps more than 10 years, but actually, no, thinking about it now, again, if you go back 80 years, you'll find some real nice solid frames. And anyway, I'm not going to go off on a bike for that.
Yeah, I mean, it's, now you come to mention it, I actually haven't bought myself a new guitar in over 20 years, so, so I've actually got nothing to compare it against. I mean,
you probably bought one of the last ones, like the sort of what's called like pre-Columbia for Fender before they moved to, before they were made in Japan, and now they're all made in China and Thailand.
I got the only Fender I own is, it is actually a Japanese Jazzmaster, but I, at that point the Japanese ones were seen as being where the budget ones were made, and then that moved to Mexico and the Japanese ones were seen as being the kind of mid-range, and then it's all been sort of slowly shunted around different kind of countries with lower wages that can be paid, and the countries that are left behind are then seen as making the better ones. Yeah, it's odd. So I don't actually have any experience of new guitars, so it may be that they are, as you say, all pants.
Well, certainly that one I bought, I think, 8 years ago or something like that. So.
I've got a nylon strung Spanish guitar that my mum bought when she was, I think she was about 19 or 20 when she bought it, and she's going to be 70 this year. And that guitar's still fine. It's got a couple of cracks in it, but it doesn't seem to mind. It's, the neck isn't warped. Everything's fine. It still plays perfectly well. It's perfectly happy to be restrung whenever. It became my main guitar for a long time because I was very lazy, and it was the lightest guitar I owned. So I didn't have to carry around something heavy when I was playing.
Yeah,
so
that's good. I mean, I love classical guitar, though, and actually my electric one, I pretty much, well, I gave it to my kids because I just enjoy playing it as much as I enjoy classical. And I started playing classical for pretty much the same reason, because I kept moving house all the time and couldn't be bothered to just dig out the amp and all the rest of it. So also, a classical guitar is the way you have to play that. It really shows how shit you are
at that. That's absolutely, it does. It's one of these things, they're not forgiving of mistakes.
No, not at all. There's nothing to hide behind. But I love it more than it. I do quite enjoy playing. Where I recorded the last album, the guy is very into guitars and proper guitars, like proper 60s ones. And that is quite nice every so often, just getting out a guitar and whacking it through an amp through some ridiculous effects. But I've got to say, the most pleasure I get is just from my classical, which is just sat less than a meter away from me right now.
Yeah, because I think it's interesting you mentioned about whacking stuff through effects, because I think one of the earliest memories I have of even reading about you was in maybe Melody Maker, and I think it was accompanied with a picture of you kind of kneeling down over a load of effects pedals with a guitar. And I can remember, because I think, because you went through the kind of that Bristol kind of there was a kind of amorphous kind of fuzz sound thing going on, wasn't there, with people like Flying Saucer Attack and stuff. And then it's, so yeah, I don't know where I'm going with that.
I still use effects and stuff, but I just use it with a classical instead of an electric. But Dave was more, well, he wasn't really into, he likes to make out that he was, or he did like to make out in those days, that he was like this sort of guitar kind of like freak. Like, I guess he saw himself like a cross between, obviously Nick Drake, but also those crazy engineer guys like Phil Spector, or not Phil Spector, the other guy, the Telstar guy. He didn't have such a great knowledge, because like those guys like really knew about amps and how amps worked and how guitars worked, but he didn't really have that kind of knowledge.
Was that Joe Meek you were thinking of?
Joe Meek is what exactly who I'm thinking of. Yeah, yeah,
someone,
yeah,
who had a studio in his weird little rented room.
I recently, just by accident, I saw the sort of biopic of his life, which was very, I thought was well done. I mean, obviously that's all I know about Joe Meek, apart from the fact that he had a special compressor and that you can buy them and this, that and the other. But the story was rich, at least to my mind, it seemed to be one of the better done biopics.
Whenever I think of him, I always think of movies like Passport to Pimlico and things like that. I don't know why, he kind of sits in my head with those kind of Ealing comedy kind of things, not so much for what he did, but maybe the kind of look of the era. if you see what I mean. I don't know why it does. But your last album, Only a Myocardial Infarction Can Break Your Heart, I think... am I right in spotting that there's a kind of... Going back through your music over a long period of time, there seems to me that there's a kind of a dark humour underneath it all as well.
Mm. Yeah, well, I think that's one thing. It's one thing going back to like what it's like to live in France. Is humour is something that's... Well, certainly my humour is, it's quite a British humour. And I think the British have a way of dealing with kind of... just dealing with life generally by laughing at it. And yeah, really, I think it's one thing that the British do really well is comedy. And yeah, you have to laugh at it. And in the old days, I was doing Third Eye Foundation, so there wasn't any lyrics or anything. There wasn't anything to say, you know, oh, the music's really heavy, but I'm not this, like, super heavy dude, you know. I'm a kind of guy that likes to laugh, you know. So that was my only way of doing it, was to kind of make the titles funny, or to try to do something witty, or to play with some words. But, yeah, I mean, I still try to do that a bit now. It's true that the last Matt Elliott albums have more kind of sensible titles, and the last one has a more kind of a comedy one, but...
It kind of reminded me a little bit of the album You Guys Kill Me in the title. And I was talking about this with my wife before we started speaking, was that I remember seeing the adverts for that album when it came out, and I can't remember whether I've got this mixed up in my head or something, but I seem to remember there being some imagery of either somebody like Thomas Wolseley or Thomas More or something, that's the guy who was arrested in the cathedral by guys that or was murdered in the cathedral or something like that, that by guys that Henry VIII sent to deal with him. And I can't remember whether I've just kind of connected the two things in my head over the years, or whether that was something that actually happened.
Well, I don't remember that being happened, but it's possible that maybe Domino used that image.
It's possible. Yeah, because there's that kind of famous kind of... It's kind of an etching of the guy in the chapel with a couple of other guys coming at him with swords. And to my mind, in my head, those two images, those two things have always been linked. Yeah, you know, the idea of,
I think you must have linked it yourself somehow. I'll check it out later and let you know, but there was only a visual.
It may have been, yeah. Oh man, it's, you know, it's been such a long time that I could have, you know, how over time things become kind of cemented.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, memory is elastic. I mean, that's like official science now. They've proved it beyond a doubt that, and even just conversations with my sister, or anyone has with their sister about things that happened 20 years ago. You think, no, it was you that said that. No, it was you. You definitely said that.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, I will always have that image, and it, to me, it makes the album title even funnier in a kind of much darker way. You know, that these are the guys that have come to kill him, and it's this kind of throwaway line of like, you guys kill me. And it's, yeah. So, yeah, I kind of don't know what happened with my brain then to have connected those things back in the late... It was the late 90s, wasn't it? Crikey.
It was, yeah, late 90s, yeah, very late 90s, 98.
That makes me feel really old, suddenly.
Oh, I'm going through one of those, because I'm going to turn 40 quite soon.
Matt.
So I'm getting to that point where I'm like, oh my God, you know, like one of those major things, like, because I can remember my father's 40th birthday, for example, and I was, you know, as a teenager, so, I mean, it was quite impressed on my memory. I can remember looking at him thinking, what an old prick.
I wish I could tell you that it isn't as horrifying as you are thinking it might be. I am 41 now, and right. Seriously, my 39th year, well, I guess it was my 40th year technically, before I turned 40 officially, I got a bit stressed about it.
I'm not really stressed, but it's just one of those things where you suddenly start kind of reflecting on things, reflecting on life a bit. I mean, you do it in your 30s. I didn't do it in my 30s. I turned 30 and I just thought, well, I'm not going to have one of those 30s crises. But a couple of years later, I did have it, where I was like, wow, that's probably half my life gone now. And then, you suddenly start realizing that it speeds up quite quickly as well.
Yeah, that is kind of horrible.
That's the worst bit, because it's like exponentially gets quicker, and I'm thinking, wow, like soon enough, I'm going to be six. I'm going to be like probably too old to ride a bike, and maybe even start losing the use of my fingers. That's if I'm even if I manage to live that long. So yeah, I think it's all those classic mortality things. But then I can remember at 13 years old just thinking, well, I'm going to die. What's the point in doing anything?
Certainly I found that I've got less like that as I've got older, because I'm now starting to think, yeah, I'm running out of time. I've got to do a lot. There's still a lot to be done, and I've still got to... I've almost reached a point where I feel that I've got to leave as much as possible behind.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah, well, I think that that's a very human thing to do, to just say I need people to know that I existed.
Yeah.
I think that that's one reason people do art, is for that, is to be remembered for something, or to say, look, I left my mark in this small way. But then ultimately we'll all be forgotten anyway, so it doesn't make any difference either.
Yeah, it's a very sobering thought.
And that's the thing, like 5 years after you're dead, you'll be lucky if someone remembers you. You know, 50 years, you'll be very lucky if someone remembers you. 500 years, almost no hope whatsoever. And yeah, 5,000 years, forget about it, you know.
I think possibly the only way that you could pull that off is to commit some colossal atrocity.
Well, that's the thing, is the worst thing is that probably Hitler will be remembered for thousands and thousands of years, you know, whereas as Mozart might have faded into history. Can you imagine that? I don't think Mozart, but maybe, you know, Gandhi or.
It's awful. I mean, it's interesting about you talking about the exponential speeding up of time. I remember reading somewhere something that, and this it depressed me immensely when I read it. This guy, I can't remember who it is, he's a guy who's doing a lot of studying into the way we perceive time as we age. And he was saying that when you get to 60, you've actually got only 5% of your perceived lifetime left.
Right.
Because it does speed up, because we measure it against what we've already experienced. So when you're 4 years old, a year seems like an eternity.
Because I can remember an hour thinking, oh my God, an hour? We've got to wait an hour, and thinking it felt like forever, yeah.
I mean, I distinctly remember, in fact, coming home when I used to, years and years ago when I lived in Nuneaton, just outside Coventry, I remember coming home from the shops one afternoon, on a Saturday afternoon, and it was something like 4:45, and Batman was on at 5. And I remember thinking, I've got to wait a whole quarter of an hour. And that's just so long. And I remember it feeling like it was just forever. And now I can sit and be doing something and suddenly realise that 5 hours have passed and I've not even noticed. It's the awful... The thing that's cruel about it as well is that I think that as I'm getting older, I could have been more comfortable with who I am. And I feel that I'm then not being given the time to explore that.
Everything is harsh and cruel about life. And exactly what you say is true, that, yeah, the older you get... Because I often think now, oh, if only I'd known all this shit when I was a kid, I just wouldn't have given it. I would have really used my youth for what it could have been. And I think that that's... I mean, I think that that's the eternal thing about... Because I can remember when I was a kid, people telling me, oh, you know, it's the best years of your life and you should love it and that. But, of course, when you're a kid, all you want to do is be an adult. You just want to grow up so quickly. And get all of that shit out of the way. You hate being a kid, you hate being young. And now, of course, you know, now I'm approaching 40. I look on these young kids just thinking, oh, you little shit, you don't even know how lucky you are. Well, you know, to be young, to, you know, have everything in front of you, the best years of your life. I mean, the 20s as well. I think that was a thing, yeah, I didn't really appreciate my 20s till they're gone, and I'll be the same with my 30s. And yeah, when I'm 70, I just think, God, I remember being 40 and bitching about it and crying about it, but still fucking ride a bike.
But this is the thing, though. I think on the other side of looking at it, though, is I think by the time you're kind of getting to your mid to late 30s and into your 40s, that realisation has dawned. And I think, though we're aware that time is passing faster, I think you hit a point where you can start to appreciate what you've got. And because with each day that passes, a little bit of it seems to go away. But I'm starting to notice that my knees hurt, and that makes me feel like an old man, that I've got hurting knees. It's so I kind of appreciate the fact that I can still go up and down the stairs, even though I complain about it.
So it's always been downhill. I remember it thinking from about like 28, oh, my body's stopping to work now properly the way it used to. I can remember running when I hadn't run for ages, and I thought, I used to run as a teenager all the time, so it should be fine. And then the next day, literally being pretty much disabled, just crying every time I had to get up to piss because I pulled my muscles in my legs. But now, I mean, now, because I think I had one of those kind of revelations quite recently. I stopped smoking. I used to be a very heavy smoker, and I stopped smoking just one day, just said, I'm going to stop smoking, and I kind of really had no urge or wish to ever become a smoker again. So, and I do that, and I cycle as much as possible. I do as much exercise as I possibly can now. So I don't know what that makes me, one of those kind of pathetic. I don't wear Lycra when I ride a bike, by the way. I haven't got to that stage, and hopefully never will. I've instructed people to sort of shoot me before that happens. So I haven't gone that far. But, yeah, I start to really take care of myself and just think, okay, you've got to look after whatever's left, because if you want it to be fun, and at least enjoy life. Because it's true, once the physical shit stops happening, I think it must start becoming quite fucking bleak.
And the thing is as well, we are living in a time where people live longer than they've ever lived before. So we're going to be old for a very long time. You know,
but that's unbearable. See, because I don't really... I don't know. I mean, I know it's easy to say that when you've got relative youth, but I just think... Like when I'm 70 or 80 and I stop being able to actually do physical fun stuff, do I really want to live? But then, of course, people who are 70 or 80 do want to live, because life itself is an experience. But at the same time, there's a part of me that almost doesn't want to see that bit where just literally you're sort of pissing and shitting yourself, or you can no longer look after yourself and you need someone there to look after you all the time. I don't know. I mean, but again, I'm sure when I get to that point, I'll just think, what was I thinking about then? Of course I want to live. Life is life. And as far as we know, we've just got one. And I'm reaching the end of mine. But then again, as well, I have spent most of my life with these sort of morbid thoughts. I mean, it's how I end up making the kind of music that I make and all that, because I'm quite a sort of moribund person. And every so often I say to myself, okay, stop stressing about life. Stop being afraid of everything and just crack on and do it. Don't stress about things, because it's pointless. It's never helped you. Even when you've stressed about something and then something stressful ends up happening. Like when I got my wallet stolen on the train, for example, a stupid example. But it's the kind of thing that I spend all my life thinking, oh, I bet my wallet's going to get nicked. And of course it doesn't most of the time. But then when it does, all of that time you spent stressing about it doesn't actually help you deal with the situation or make it feel any better or lighter. If anything, it makes it worse. So in that respect, it's pointless stressing about things. But then when I find I don't stress about things, that's when bad stuff starts happening. But I think that there's a part of my brain that thinks if I stress about it, it kind of exercises it. So there's this constant kind of stress kind of loop that where I'm always saying, like, stress less, and then I stop stressing, but then bad stuff happens. So then I start to stress again.
I constantly get told off by my wife. I'm married to an American, and she constantly tells me off for worrying that we're going to be burgled or that I'm going to be pickpocketed. Or so I neurotically check my pockets to make sure I know where everything is all the time.
I mean, in one pocket I keep some shit, and in the other pocket I keep that shit, and never the twain shall meet.
Absolutely,
I can never understand these people where they say, oh, where's my phone? And they're checking like every single one of them. Oh, where do you keep your, where's your phone pocket? It's in your phone pocket, right?
My wife is sat next to me laughing at the moment. Because I do exactly that in my right pocket.
No, I'm laughing because I'm going, where's my phone?
Yeah, she goes, where's my pocket? Where's... this is Kat, who you can hear laughing in the background.
Hi.
She will be looking through things, and I'll be finding that stressful. I'll be going, what are you looking for? Why isn't it in your pocket? Why isn't it where it should be?
Exactly. I carry, when I'm traveling, I always carry the same things in my pocket, and I know, even without touching with my hand, if there's something missing there.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I'm going to have to geek out here and tell you the way my ordering goes. I am of the generation that I inherited this from my father. I still use a handkerchief. Yes, some people think it's disgusting, but at the same time, it's not wasteful. You know,
I mean, there's often been times where I thought I wish I had a bloody handkerchief. So I'm with you on that.
So I always have in my right hand trouser pocket handkerchief, wallet, keys. And some lip balm and a hair tie in the little kind of special pocket, which I don't know what it's for, but that's what I've decided it's for.
Okay, I know what you want. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Other pocket, usually phone and possibly my iPod. And keys will never go in the left-hand pocket, neither will wallet. And
scratch your iPod or your phone, right?
Exactly! You see, Kat, this is the reason.
I would go through what my pockets are, but I'm afraid that there's pickpockets listening one day, and they'll say, wait, he keeps his thing in his back pocket. So I'm not going to say what I keep in mind, but I have quite the same. It's a lot like, since I stopped smoking, that's one of the many benefits of stopping smoking, is not worrying about not having any cigarette papers or anything like that. And not having tobacco on your lip balm, for example.
Yes. I'm glad to find out that I'm not the only person who does this. I mean, it is very much a case. And I won't put things in my back pockets.
No way, of course. The back pockets is for, you know, people who want to lose shit, you know?
Yeah, that occasionally litter will go in my back pocket.
Yeah. Litter and the kind of credit card receipts that aren't any use for anyone because you can't claim anything back. Can't do anything with them, so I screw them up and put them in my back pocket. Also, instead of a handkerchief, I personally keep, if I'm travelling, I'll keep a certain amount of toilet roll because I use it as like a sort of hand condom for like locking the door in a toilet, in a train toilet, so I don't actually have to touch the lock on the door. No one wants to do that. But then I wouldn't want to do that with a hanky that I'm then going to wipe my nose with, do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
But I'm not having a go at your hanky. I'm just saying that's my personal.
No, I mean, and again, this is a complete kind of off-topic kind of thing. Talking about toilets on trains, I also have the fear of those ones with the automated doors.
Horrible things. Those are horrible, horrible things. Only a complete sadist, and the worst kind of sadist, a sadist who designs something and doesn't even care, doesn't even have to watch it in action. They just know that it exists already. They keep them laughing for the rest of their life, just amusing themselves, thinking, ha 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 ha, how many people had the door open on them while they were in the middle of doing that today? That's the worst kind of sadist.
Because they're so... What was that, Kat?
I know someone who had the door open on them.
It must have happened to one. I mean, I think it's never happened to me, but I've seen it happen to other people.
Yeah.
And in the worst situation, just before we're coming into a station and the door just slowly opened. Unsuspecting person. And of course, the door's always miles away. There's nothing you can do. And anyway, whatever you could do, how could that possibly hide your shame? I mean, what is the only thing you can do is just, I guess, laugh is probably the best reaction you can do, or stand up and do a dance or something, you know, do something completely, but yeah, it must be horrific.
You think they'd put an emergency closed door next to you?
A big red lever that definitely says this definitely won't stop the train, but it will stop people seeing you mid.
Yeah. Because it's never good, and it never happens to people when they're stood up using it. It always seems to be when people are sat down, and you can't do anything. Your trousers around your ankles. What do you?
I don't know. I don't know who would sit. I mean, I think as a woman, I'd try to devise a way of pissing.
Not sitting makes it worse if the door opens, because my colleague was hovering, trying to wee, sort of half standing up, leaning over when the door opened. So she's sort of mid piss and standing up, and people can see her weeing.
Oh God!
I don't. Is that worse or not? I mean, to be honest, if the door opened and I saw a woman doing that, I would assume that that's how most women piss, right? I mean, me, if I was a lady, I would do that. There's no way my ass would touch that seat. No way, not in this earth. Even if it had one of those Anyway, I don't want to go. It wouldn't shock me or surprise me that much. I just say, yeah, fair enough on you, because I would be the same in that situation.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'll drive things away from pissing on
toilet
public transport.
I know, it's horrible, especially I spent half my life on trains anyway. I mean, I'm an expert on trains, certainly the trains of France. I mean, I can tell you anything.
Well, before we put that topic to bed, I will say that the only thing that is worse than train toilets is those horrible little toilets on coaches.
Yeah, I mean, I don't travel by... I mean, I'm 6 foot five, so I don't travel by coach. I mean, I haven't traveled by coach through choice since I was about 18. And I think a couple of times I've ended up being on a coach, and it's been so horrendous that it's just basically not an option for me at all.
No, it's the last time I was on a coach. It was on a work had a kind of general meeting type thing up in Sheffield. So we travelled up from Birmingham, and the coach, the driver, for some reason, I have in my head that he was wearing a cowboy hat and cowboy boots. And I think he might have been, and had a moustache. And he was like something out of a kind of Alan Partridge sketch or something. But he insisted on just driving for hours without stopping to let anybody go to the toilet. So there was this horrible little toilet at the back. And I remember going in, and the light wouldn't come on, and the water wouldn't work, and, you know, getting thrown around. And I remember coming out and thinking, you know what, I'd have actually had more dignity if I'd have just sat and weed myself.
Yeah, just piss yourself in the pan. Yeah, I mean, it's true. When I was, like, 16, I was going out with a girl who was going to Oxford University, so I was going there, like, every other weekend on the bus because I was a 16-year-old kid with barely any income. And that was horrible because it was a two-hour journey, I guess, maybe a bit more. But I was a goth in those days, and I definitely didn't want to be the goth going to the top. Apart from anything, as I said, I'm 6 foot five already. I had the hair and everything all over the place. I didn't want to be then have to go, because on that particular coach, it was halfway down the coach, and you had to go down some stairs. It was like this, you, instead of going out down through the door that lets you out of the coach, it's just on your left. And yeah, everything about it was just humiliating. So I remember just staring out at the field, just thinking I'd do anything to be in that field now, because at least I could piss if I was in that field. And it was horrible.
But again, it's one of those things that I've managed to get over this recently, but I remember every time I got on something where there would be no chance of me using the toilet, that as soon as I sat down, no matter whether I needed to go or not, I would sit down and immediately sit there going, can't go to the loo, need to go to the loo.
No, I mean, I'm quite the same, like, on planes and stuff. I mean, I don't take planes often because I don't really like it. But also, I have to drink quite a lot of gin to get onto a plane. So those minutes between the very last running backwards and forwards to have a last piss, then you get ferried onto the plane. That takes 20 minutes. Then you sit down. Then you have to taxi and all that. And all of that time that you cannot go to the toilet lights on. And then basically as soon as we're clear and the seatbelt sign goes off, I need to climb over whoever the hell is sat next to me and stumble up drunken to the toilet to piss. And that can happen. I mean, on a 1.5 hour flight, I've normally drunk enough gin that I needed to probably piss about five times. It's why I can't go Ryanair, because it would cost me double.
You see, the thing is, I'm hoping that there's people listening to this podcast who are going, oh, thank God it's not just me.
Well, no, I think they might find that it's maybe just me and perhaps you on some of the other things.
I think my wife would probably agree with that. Well, we should probably draw things to a close, but before we do, we should maybe talk about what's coming up next for you in musical terms.
Touring. I'm just touring endlessly. Well, not endlessly. It ends in April. So, but I have, if we're virtually in March, I have Italy, Greece, Spain, one show in Madrid, and that's that. And then I'm going to have some time off.
Yeah, you see, when you said, you know, it finishes in April, I was about to say next month, like the Hootenanny.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Actually, you know what, I might actually make a Christmas show and record it in August.
Yeah, Yeah, I must say, I'm exhausted from all the touring I've been doing in February.
It's been a tough month, hasn't it? But
Wow, I'm exhausted. It's a miracle I can still even think straight.
Well, it's a credit to you that after all that touring you did in February and some of March, that you're able to even speak.
Yeah, I'm not even sure when we managed to get it done. But, yeah.
So if people want to find out more about you online, where should they point their little arrows on the screen?
Well, as much as I hate it, probably Facebook, because I have a kind of fan page there, which is the only thing that I bother to sort of keep up to date. I don't really have a Twitter account or anything like that. MySpace has gone to shit. I do have an official website, but again, there's a kind of change. It's not my, I'm not in charge of the website, so sometimes it's not as, I mean, it's Facebook, it's the I know it's terrible, it's tragic, because Facebook represents pretty much everything I hate about society, but at the same time, in some ways it represents some of the good things about the internet, in that you can pretty much say what you want and do what you want. Although there does seem to be a certain sort of tier level, because some people get banned and stuff. I mean, I've always had the policy of, I'll just say what the hell I want on Facebook, and I guess I'll know I've gone too far one day when I get an email saying, you're not on Facebook anymore. So far, nothing's happened to be banned for me.
I've been banned a couple of times, but purely because of my other podcast, where I kind of get involved with arguing with the religious.
I noticed a couple of those... Yeah. But what happens when they ban you? They ban your account, or they give you like a little warning and say, look, don't talk about that?
Well, you firstly get a 12-hour ban.
But what, see, like, what's the chain of event that happens?
Okay.
Makes a complaint against you.
Yeah, so somebody makes a complaint about something completely innocuous you've said about God, or something like that. You know, because obviously God can't come and, you know, press the complaint button himself, even though he's apparently omnipotent. So somebody else, one of his little helpers, comes along and presses complain. And then usually the first thing I know that something's gone wrong is that I go to log in on my phone at work, and it tells me I have to log in again. And I think, why do I have to log in again? And then it comes up and it says, login failed, you must log in online. And at that point I think, oh, for fuck's sake, somebody's reported me and I've been banned. So I get to a browser, go on the proper computer, get to the browser, and I open it, and the first thing it does, it tells you to log in. You go in, and the first thing that comes up is saying, Facebook removed this content for it violating this thing in our community guidelines. And sometimes there's a little screenshot of whatever you've done or image you've posted, and then it tells you how long you're banned for.
Right.
And you can't appeal it, you can't do anything to...
I mean, I know that about the internet, yeah, I mean, but I guess, if you're sort of having, like, debates and stuff with people, that's more likely to happen. I guess anything I put on my Facebook, I guess most people think, okay, yeah, that's what he's like. So I guess there's not people like saying, I'm really offended by this guy, he's obviously an anarchist.
the only person I've seen who's been banned, who's kind of more high profile, is Limmy. Keeps on getting banned, the Scottish comedian.
The guy that he's on Charlie Brook.
Yeah, yeah. Right. He got banned for he made some joke about, I can't remember what it was, and he got banned for, people claimed it was racist when it was in fact the exact opposite. Oh, that was it. He said, post something along the lines of, he says, here's what you should do on your Facebook page. Post something like, I love Hitler. And then if anybody likes it, unfriend them.
Right.
And it all went wrong and he got banned. And then he commented via his Twitter account saying, I've just been banned from this. And then he keeps on getting banned from Twitter as well for posting pictures of his willy. So.
Right.
But, you know, that's Limmy. That's what Limmy does.
I guess, I mean, like I said, I only know him from Charlie Brooker, so I don't know.
His comedy's very good. I like him a lot. Actually, that reminds me of one last thing I was going to ask you about, which I should have asked you before. I think you're the only person I've ever encountered who's remixed Chris Morris.
Right. Well, Amon Tobin did some work with him as well, yeah.
How about
that? Yeah, that was for a project a long time ago, I think. Yeah, when he was doing Jam and all that, Blue Jam. The radio series, which was I don't know, I preferred it to the TV series because I think it was so brilliantly written that it messed with your mind in a much better way than the series could do. Anyway, when he was doing that, I think he just had lots of ideas, and I think in some ways he's a frustrated musician, And I mean, he does some a lot of the music that was on Brass Eye and stuff. I think he's responsible for, and I think he knows a lot about music. He knows a fuck of a lot about funk music, because I had some, not podcasts, but like radio shows of his back in the day, and he really knows about like funk. In fact, I really love funk, funkadelic, and all that kind of thing, and half of that's down to him, because he used to play some really awesome funk on his shows, just little bits of it. Anyway, so he, I think he got in touch with a bunch of musicians. I think at the time he wanted to release a kind of a bunch of remixes or so of the Jam, of Blue Jam. It was from the radio. Yeah, it was from the radio for sure. And there you go. So I did something for him, but I think he thought that I just put loads of effects on and stuff, but actually everything I used in that, except for two piano chords, was from the Jam, from the Blue Jam DATs that he gave me. So, but I think, I don't know, maybe I did stuff with it that he thought was other instruments or something, because I subsequently heard from someone else that he, that, because all the other people had just basically put, done some tune and then chucked a couple of samples from Blue Jam on it, whereas I kind of stuck to the thing. Anyway, whatever. But in the end, he ended up just doing something, I think, with Eamon Tobin, which I think he ended up working with him a bit more, kind of hands-on, to do a 10-inch that I think came out on Ninja Tune, maybe. Anyway, so that was that. And so the tune that I did for him, it ended up not getting used, so I asked him if I could release it on the I Poo Poo On Your Juju, and he graciously said yes, so I did, because I was quite happy with the tune.
Excellent. So, right, so that really draws things really nicely to close. It's, I could have loathed to draw things to close, because I thoroughly enjoy it, but, you know, time is of the essence. Matt, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you.
Likewise.
It's I think it's the most I've laughed in quite a long time on one of these. And it's again made me kind of feel that I am doing the right thing when we can have a lengthy conversation about pissing on trains.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's been interesting to just ramble away a bit there. Yeah, and anytime you want to do it again.
Absolutely. Well, I will be more than happy to have you back on maybe in a year's time or something, to see how, or wait till you've turned 40 and then see how you're feeling then.
Yeah, see how I get on the other side. Yeah,
on the other side of 40, you know. When you've grown a great big, actually I was going to say when you've grown a ponytail, but then I've just realised that I've actually got hair halfway down my back now.
I did the long hair thing when I was young, and my hair doesn't, it's not very conducive to long hair. It grows outwards, and then a long time afterwards turns into some kind of longish hair, but it's not conducive, so I just keep it nice and short there.
See, mine's gone up and down throughout my life, and there's, you can find photographs of me throughout since I was like 17, where sometimes it's really long, sometimes it's really short, and it, you know, it's just how it is. But yeah, I'm going through a long phase with a beard and everything at the moment, so maybe that is a midlife crisis. My wife's nodding her head.
You can't stop it, though. That's the thing. It just keeps on growing. So, you know, it's fair enough to just leave it sometimes. It's true, when I'm touring, I don't shave, or I take the sort of attitude that I'm like a sailor at sea, basically. So I don't shave and cut my hair until I get home.
That's what I'm going to tell people. If they say, why is your hair long? And you say, well, I'm like a sailor at sea.
Exactly. I'm still lost at sea. And when I come home to port, then I'll sort myself out.
Yeah. I might say I'm a sailor on the seas of life, and I don't have time to shave.
I'm mid-ocean right now, so just get out of the
I'm 40 years from shore.
Exactly.
And it's maybe going to be another 40 or 50 till I'm at shore again, so get off my case, Gillette Nazi.
Just get out of my face and stop telling me what to do.
Yeah. And on that bombshell, we shall draw things to a close. Matt Elliott, thank you ever so much.
Cheers.
I'll be very glad to have you back on. And all that's left is a future library goodbye. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Quand le tyran
qu'à sa fin a pris contrôle. Et nos vies seront cachées à trimer. Et nous valons moins que notre roi dans le pétrole. Mais les actionnaires seront payés. Mais c'est nous qui en payerons le prix. Et j'espère la révolution viendra. Et notre dernière chanson saisira. Sors, go enculé. Et 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 ça, 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 go enculé. Thank you.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Future Library. Future Library is brought to you by PetPiranha.com and is hosted by myself, Alex Bottom. The podcast is free, but if you do want to show your appreciation, feel free to go along to alexbottom.co.uk and click through to music, where you'll be able to find things that you can buy, or go to asmallglassghost.co.uk where you can buy my latest music. Episodes come out when I feel like it, mostly weekly. But that's it, so thank you for listening. Thank you.